Esme relayed requests for tools, for materials, for personnel. Several glitches required intervention from above. She sicked Commander Ceviche's office on the stubborn senior chief in the technical schools, who didn't see why an instructor in weapons systems should dismiss a class and go help deal with the mine. He'd argued that the 14th was supposed to have its own bomb disposal squad, but polite requests through appropriate channels soon produced a cheerful woman with one prosthetic hand and her custom EVA suit slung on her back. Esme directed her to the right EVA hatch and went back to work. She would have liked to watch the work on Wraith. She knew only vaguely what a foam bed was and what it was supposed to accomplish. But Patak's construction teams had found more casualties in the forward compartments, most dead and the rest unconscious.
The artificial gravity failed up here, along with the communications lines. Some shrapnel probably sliced them open. It's a wonder any of them are alive. But they're all out now, so you can send over the next load of stuff as soon as they're logged clear of the lanes.
Esme looked at the cluttered screen that now represented everything between Kosciusko and Wraith. A query to the scan supervisor tagged the medical evac pod on her screen. When it was out of the way, she put a priority tag on the shipment Patak had asked for and talked to the sergeant minor in T3 responsible for sending it off.
Wow! Well, good thing they foamed it.
Esme had been concentrating so hard on keeping up with Patak's requests that Sivir's outburst had made her jump.
The mine?
Yeah. Want a replay?
He transferred the replay to her console. Wraith's hull breach no longer faced Kosciusko. She could just see the edge of it. That meant the mine was out of line of sight. The viewpoint shifted. Now, where she remembered the mine should be, an irregular grayish blob strongly sidelit by Kosciusko's floods.
They took this from a pod relayed on tight beam.
This view closed in until she could see that the blob looked like whipped cream or icing piped into a slumpy cylinder. As she watched, another blob of foam appeared, rising, then slipping sideways to seal off the end of the cylinder.
They foamed all the compartments inboard and foamed a cylinder around it, aiming it away from us, then finally put a lobe over the top. That's when...
Oh!
The blob of the foam bed burst apart, and something shot out the top, away from Wraith.
See? All the ejecta went the right way. Good design. Reports are that very little blew in the interior. All they have to do now is get all that foam back out, and we can do that in the big bay.
I don't understand how it works. I thought if you confined an explosion, that only made it worse.
I don't really understand it either. And I had a buddy back in Sector 10 who was in their bomb squad. He said you had a choice. You could try to aim it somewhere and let all that energy escape in a direction that didn't bother you. Or you could put enough padding around it to absorb the force.
But the foam bed blew apart.
Well, maybe it needed to be thicker. But it was thick enough to aim the ejecta in a direction that doesn't bother us. Notice where it's going?
Away from Kos is all I know or care.
Toward the jump point exit. We can always hope some fool blood-horned ship comes roaring in here and gets a mouthful of its own bullet.
Esme watched as Wraith's damaged bow edged into the repair bay. It was easy to forget how large that bay was, empty, but the ship gave a reference for the eye.
Sweeza, quit looking at the view and give me a readout.
Yes, sir.
Esme glanced at her board. Patak's concern was the change in center of gravity as Wraith entered Kosciusko's artificial gravity field. Rapid changes could stress the internal structure of Kosciusko beyond safe limits.
Is Wraith's artificial gravity on in any part of the ship?
No, it's not.
There's a torque force developing in the contralateral midsections, only 5.4 dynes right now, but it's increasing in a linear relationship to the mass of Wraith within Kos's field.
That's expected. Not desirable, but expected. Transfer a plot of that to my screen and to power.
Yes, sir.
Esme locked in the curve, keyed for the transfers, and continued to watch her board. Her gaze kept twitching upward to the view of Wraith's approach, but she yanked it back each time. The strain she'd noticed dipped below the curve.
It's dropped below line.
Good. That means power is compensating. But watch for that bulge ahead of the damage. That's something we can't really model for the field generator.
Centimeter by centimeter, Wraith edged in, and the mooring lines were secured.
Shifting in T-minus 15 minutes.
Esme transferred her final readouts to Major Patak and Power, then withdrew to a monitoring station behind the double red lines. Only a few essential personnel would ride the cradles during shift.
I hate to think what that mine would have done to the cradle mechanisms.
Esme glanced back at the voice. Baron Serrano, his dark brows lowered.
It's taken care of.
Esme wondered what he was doing there. His assignment in scan wasn't needed at the moment.
Lieutenant Bondal sent me down here to see if Major Patak had decided where to put the new RSV units.
She hasn't told me, but I'll check for you. Have you heard anything about Bloodhorde ships coming in?
No, and I'm sure I would have, because... Well, anyway, I would have. But I know that Sting and Justice have jumped out.
Why?
They delivered Wraith, and they're supposed to be patrolling out wherever they were. Maybe they thought they'd spot anyone following Wraith's trail in.
Pack leader Volkrace woke to the bustle of a medical ward. When he turned his head, he saw his pack second, Hoch, staring back at him.
What happened?
Freaking sleepy gas. We got hauled in as casualties. I don't think this is the same ship.
They lay, struggling to make sense of what they were seeing and hearing.
They're on the DSR, right inside.
Or two of us.
Volkrace lifted his head cautiously, since no one seemed to be paying any attention to him. He was wearing a clean, pale blue shift of some crinkled fabric, and all up and down the rows of beds were the rest of his assault team, dressed the same way. Most of them, anyway. He counted only 25 of the original 30, and Tar-Yolt wasn't there, their technical expert, the one who knew most about Familius technology. Nor Kerai, nor Sig. His mind ticked off the missing and consigned them to either of the two possible eternal destinations. The rest were there, all butt naked in hospital gowns, but all awake now, staring at him. Before he had time to worry about how he was going to get his team clothed and out of medical, a heavyset man with a scowl worthy of a Bloodhorde senior sergeant bustled down the aisle between the beds.
All right, nap time's over. None of you got worse than a dose of trank. Come with me. I'll get you clean clothes and put you to work. We'll need your help to get Wraith repaired.
Our IDs?
I've got them. Already passed on the stats to supply, so you'll have something close to fitting.
Volkrace rolled out of bed, surprised to find that he wasn't at all dizzy. The others followed. He saw arms twitch as the automatic habit of saluting conflicted with awareness of their position. Their guide didn't notice. He was scowling at a list in his hand.
Santini?
Volkrace scrabbled through his memory and finally remembered that the name tag on the uniform he'd stolen had been something like that.
Yes, sir.
Wake up, Santini. Says here you were a specialist in ventilation.
Volkrace wondered if that was ventilation as in airflow, or ventilation as in perforating an enemy with a sharp object.
Sir.
That's good. Send you over to support systems as soon as you got your gear. Oh, and Kamaho?
Volkrace prayed to the heartrender that someone would have the sense to say something.
Kamaho!
yes, sir?
Oh, shit. I guess you're all still dazed. They told me to give you another hour, but we need help now. Kamaho, report to Major Patak in H&A. Now, let's see. Braddington!
The others caught on quicker now, and Volkrace wondered if the others remembered the names on the uniforms they'd stripped from dead men, or if they were just answering blind. It probably didn't matter. Supposedly, the Familius ships had a fancy way of figuring out who was really one of their own, but so far he hadn't seen any sign of it. Eventually, all of them had answered to their new names. Names which felt uncomfortable, even held so lightly. Names with no family chant behind them. For a moment, Volkrace wondered if the strangers' families had chance of their own. But this was not the right kind of thought for the belly of an enemy ship. He pushed it away, and it fell off his mind like a landsman off the deck of a dragon ship in rough seas. Instead, he thought of the battle to come. The hot blood of enemies that would soak his clothes. Not cold and clammy this time, but properly steaming. He had not minded stripping the dead and putting on their blood-soaked uniforms. Not after the rituals of the blooding, but it had been distasteful to feel it already cold. His pack followed him through the enemy ship. He could feel their amusement, even as his own bubbled just beneath the surface. The enemy. More like prey than enemy. Like sheep leading a wolf into the fold in the mistaken notion that it was a sheepdog. Even as Vokreis accepted a folded pile of clothes, he was sure that his pack could have taken the ship bare naked with only their blood hunger. Instead, he dressed quickly, carefully, not meeting anyone's eyes. He had worn Familius clothing before, in his years as a spy. The soft cloth, the angled fastenings, felt almost as familiar as his own. The lack of weapons didn't. He missed the familiar pressure of Needler and Stunner, Knocknab and Gutstab. Familius troops carried weapons only into battle, and DSRs didn't fight. The helpful enemy had leapfrogged them over the first two phases of the plan, handing them the chance to disperse throughout the ship. With any luck at all, and the gods definitely seemed to be loading luck upon them, no one from Wraith would notice that the men wearing the uniforms of shipmates were not shipmates at all. Vokreis followed the route displayed on the palm-sized mapcom, sure that he could deal with whatever he found when he arrived.
No, I'm not going to send anyone from Wraith back over there. Not after they've been knocked out for a week or so with sleepy gas. Their cogs won't be meshing for another two shifts. We don't want accidents.
Vokreis heard the end of that and wondered whether feigning mental illness would do anything useful. Probably not. They might send him back to the medical area, or he could end up in bed with no pants on. Better to seem dutiful but slightly confused. The confusion, at least, was honest enough. Familius' technology impressed him as it had before. So much of it, and it worked so well. No familiar stench of sweat and gut breath. Clean air emerged from one grill and vanished into another. The lights never flickered. The artificial gravity felt as solid as a planet. The little communications device and the data wand he'd been given were smaller and worked better than their analogs on the Bloodhorde ship. This was what they had come for, after all. The technology they had not been able to buy or steal or, last and least efficient ploy, invent. Bigger ships, better ships, ships that could take on Familius and compassionate hand cruisers and win. The technicians to keep the technology working. Vokreis eyed the others around him. They didn't look like much, but he had somewhat overcome the prejudice of his upbringing. He knew that smart minds could hide in bodies of all shapes, but hardly one in 50 looked like any kind of warrior. Meanwhile, his pack was dispersed throughout the DSR very handily. Probably several supervisors would decide, as his had, to assign them simple duties. Eventually, a meal would come, and they'd have access to eating utensils, so easily converted to effective hand weapons. An hour, two. Vokreis worked on, willing enough to sort parts, package them in trays, stack them on automatic carriers. There was no hurry. They had gained time by being put to sleep and admitted as casualties, an irony he hoped to be able to share at the victory feast with his commander. Once, he caught a glimpse of another pack member, carrying something he didn't recognize. For an instant, their gazes crossed. Then the other man looked away. Yes, huge as this ship might be, they would locate one another, and their plan would work. And the longer they had to explore it, to learn its capabilities, the easier to slit its guts open when the time came. Esme glanced up as a shadow crossed her screen. Camajo, the name tag said, clipped to a uniform that fit its wearer like a new saddle. Technically fitting, but uneasy in some way. The insignia of a petty light had been applied recently and not quite straight to his sleeve.
I was told to report here, to Major Patak.
His eyes roved the compartment as if scanning it for hidden weapons. His glance at Esme had been dismissive. Her skin prickled. He reminded her of something, someone. Her mind, suddenly alert, scrabbled frantically in her memory to figure out what. She looked back at the screen before she answered.
She's in with Commander Ceviche. Are you with Wraith?
She couldn't imagine anyone from Kosciusko giving her quite that look. It wasn't the "you're not really fleet, are you" look, or the "you're that kid who commanded despite, are you" look, or any of the others she'd have recognized.
Yes, sir.
The pause snagged her attention away from the screen graphics again.
We were in the forward compartment. The sleepy gas.
Esme instantly forgave the man's odd behavior. If he'd been through all that, he could still be affected by the drug.
You're lucky to be alive. We've got Wraith in now. Work's already started. You can wait here for Major Patak or at Commander Ceviche's office.
Where's Commander Ceviche's office?
The ship chip in his pocket bleeped, and he peered cross-eyed at a space between him and Esme. She knew what that meant. The ship chip was projecting a route.
Just follow your ship chip.
He turned, without the proper acknowledgement. Esme started to say something, but he had been gassed and might still be a bit hazy. Something wasn't quite right.
Pettylight?
He stopped in mid-stride, then turned jerkily. Something not right at all. His eyes were not the eyes of someone dazed by drugs. His eyes had a bright gleam half hidden behind lowered lids.
Yes, Lieutenant?
Esme could not define what was wrong. It was not anything so positive as disrespect, which she had experienced often enough. Respect and disrespect occurred in a relationship, a connection. Here she felt no connection at all, as if Pettylight Camajo were not Fleet at all, but a civilian.
When you see Major Patak, tell her that the simulations for fabrication have arrived from Specmat.
The simulations have arrived. Yes, sir.
Camajo turned, moving more decisively than someone fogged on sleepy gas, and was gone before Esme could say more. She scowled at the screen. What had he been about to say? She felt uneasy. Did Wraith have traitors on its crew? Was that why it suffered such damage? Why was Camajo alive, uninjured, after such a hull breach between him and the rest of the ship? This was ridiculous. She had not noticed anything amiss, and despite, had not recognized that any of the traitors were traitors. Camajo had been lucky, that was all, and now he was disoriented, on a strange ship with none of his familiar companions. Still, that didn't work out. The casualties on Despite, traitor or loyal, had none of them stumbled over the familiar Fleet greetings and honorifics. With blood in his mouth, as he died, Chief Major Barscott had answered yes, sir, to Esme. How many of the survivors in those forward compartments had been lucky? And was it luck? Camajo's eyes, his gaze, reminded her of her father's soldiers. Ground Pounder's eyes, Commando's eyes, roving, assessing, looking for the weaknesses in a position, thinking how to take over. Take over what? Shaking her head, Esme flicked to the next screen, but her mind wandered anyway. In the Califer uprising, both sides had tried infiltrating the other's defensive positions with troops wearing stolen uniforms, using stolen ID. It had worked a few times. She'd never heard of such a thing happening in Fleet. Ships weren't infiltrated by individuals. They were attacked by other ships. Pirates sometimes boarded individual commercial vessels, but that wasn't the military.
It would take a single badly damaged fleet ship. One that could not detect the movement of individuals in EVA gear. A hull breach that let them in. A way to get the right uniforms. No, that's silly.
Major Patak came in while she was still arguing with herself, dropping a half dozen cubes onto her desk.
That Camajo fellow from Wraith must still be half-tranked. I couldn't get out of him which simulations we're in. I sent him on down to E-12. They can use him for a runner if nothing else. Can't cause much trouble that way.
Major, I was wondering about a security breach.
Security breach? What are you talking about?
Camajo, I'm not sure, but something wasn't right.
He'd been out for a week. That scrambles anyone's brain. How could he be a security breach?
He just didn't react the way he should. The way he looked at me, it wasn't a tranked out sort of expression.
You've been through a mutiny. If it hasn't made you paranoid, maybe you would notice something wrong. So you think he might be a traitor, like Hearn or Garavay?
No, sir. I was thinking, what if someone infiltrated Wraith? Through the hull breach, maybe. Couldn't Blood Horde troops have gotten in there before Wraith jumped out?
You mean like boarding a warship in a pirate story? Nobody does that, Sweeza, not in real life in deep space. Even pirates send people over in pods. Besides, how would they survive through jump?
Well, there were survivors in the forward compartments.
But those were Wraith crew, in Wraith uniforms, with their names on the crew list. I was there myself, Sweeza. I didn't see anything that looked like Blood Horde commandos. Just wounded who'd been knocked out by sleepy gas to conserve oxygen.
You're sure?
Unless you're suggesting that the Blood Horde cleverly dressed their soldiers in our uniforms, uniforms that just happened to have the right ID patterns in the cloth and the right name tags on the pockets, and wounded them, drenched them in their own blood, then left them there to jump in a damaged ship?
I suppose they really were wounded?
I'm no medic. How would I know? They were unconscious and covered with blood, wearing our uniform. What more do you want?
Kamaho wasn't wounded. I think I'll check with sickbay if you don't mind.
Suiza, am I not giving you enough to do? Let medical worry about the wounded unless you want to transfer over there.
No, sir.
All right, Suiza. If you're worried about something, just spit it out.
Sir, I have a bad feeling. The thing is, sir, if they could get close enough to hand plant a mine, they could have put some troops aboard.
Without anyone noticing? That's...
Sir, Wraith was isolated at the time of the attack. Individuals in EVA gear, or even in small pods, wouldn't have shown up on scans by Justice and Sting. Wraith's own scan was badly damaged. The tactical analysis suggested that the Blood Horde might want to capture a DSR, not just destroy one. I know we don't usually consider the Blood Horde as having this sort of planning ability, but consider, if they could get a commando team aboard the DSR, they could cause enough disruption to make it easier for a follow-up ship or wave of ships to board and capture it.
I can see where that might be a plan, Suiza. But I repeat, those wounded wore our uniform. Our uniform! With a fleet recognition code in the weave. You think they stole a bale of our cloth and made up uniforms, then stole Wraith's personnel list?
No, sir. Suppose they boarded forward of the breach, counting on the confusion. Communications to the forward compartments failed with the damage, so whatever they did up there wouldn't be known aft. They could have overpowered any uninjured crew, killed them, put on their uniforms, jettisoned their own uniforms, and the dead.
It still sounds like something out of an adventure cube, Suiza, not like real life. On the other hand, the Blood Horde go for the dramatic. You would argue, then, that the blood belonged to the real RSS personnel, now dead, and that inside those bloody uniforms, the enemy were unwounded?
Yes, sir. Unless jump transit did them some harm. Those compartments weren't any too sound, you said.
No. I must say, Suiza, your passion for completeness can be a real pain sometimes. We had enough to do already.
Major Patak reached for the comm switch.
But I'll check.
For the time it took for Patak to work her way through the obstacles the medical section put in the way of the merely curious, Esme tried to settle to her own assignment. The lines and figures blurred on the screen. She kept seeing in her mind what she had not seen with her own eyes. The dark compartments of Wraith's bow section, cluttered with debris and unconscious men and women. She ran her stylus along a column of figures, trying to force her mind to some useful task, while listening to Patak's end of the conversation with medical.
Oh, interesting. I helped evacuate some of them, you know, and they were covered with blood. Yes, I see. Just the effect of the sleepy gas? Are they still in sickbay, then? When?
Patak's eyes met Esme's.
I see. If you retain this habit of being right, Suiza, you're going to be hated. They weren't wounded. Any of them. 25 males. Seemed a little dazed and confused when they woke up, and 3 hours ago they were sent off to various workstations around the ship. Kamaho, as we both know, was sent here, to H&A. If they were Blood Horde, that many Blood Horde loose in our ship could do us real damage.
Yes, sir.
And I don't even know where they are. A petty chief named Barahide from personnel came and got them. Not somebody from Wraith, because all Wraith personnel who aren't in sickbay are busy helping our people with damage assessment.
As she talked, Patak was scrolling through the communications tree.
Ah, here we are. Extension 7762. Of course, that's if they really are Blood Horde. They might not be. We need someone from Wraith, or rather the captain does. But I'll see what Barahide can tell me.
Someone might take a look at the communications lines from the forward compartments to the rear in Wraith. Was it explosive damage, or were they cut?
Good idea, Suiza. You call my chief and tell him to check. Ah, Chief Barahide. Major Patak, listen, about those Wraith crew you took out of sickbay.
Baron tried not to think about Esme Suiza. He had enough to do, if only he could concentrate on it. Besides, she was two ranks above him. He was a mere boy to her. He told himself that, but he didn't believe it. She respected him. After that first disastrous argument, she had treated him as an equal. He felt himself scowling. This wasn't about respect, exactly. It was about... He squirmed, trying to push the thought aside. Planet-born and higher-ranked. He had no good reason to be thinking of her that way, and he was. Her soft brown hair made his Serrano black hair look harsh. Her height made Serrano compactness look stubby. The back of her neck, even her elbows... He didn't want to feel this, and he did. Serranos, his mother had said, fall hard when they fall. He had taken that as he took most of the things he was told about his inheritance, with far more than one grain of salt. His mother was not a Serrano. Her occasional sarcasms might be envy. His adolescent crushes had been obvious even to him as temporary flares of hormonal activity. He had expected to find someone, if he ever did, in the respectable ranks of Fleet's traditional families. A Levati, perhaps. A Dameron. There was one of his year, a sleek, green-eyed beauty with the supple Dameron back. If they had been assigned to the same ship... But they hadn't been. This was unsuitable. He knew that. Grandmother would raise those eyebrows. Mother would sigh that sigh. His distant cousin Harris would... He didn't want to think about her, either. The rumor was that she had chosen an unsuitable partner, but he didn't think that would make her sympathetic. The part of his mind that had not wandered off down this seductive lane prodded him back to alertness. Commander Voorhees would have his head on a platter if he didn't get those scan components out of inventory and down to the repair bay in a hurry. He shook his head at his own folly and caught an amused glance from another ensign he knew.
Hey, Serrano, you hear about the mysterious intruders?
Intruders? What intruders?
Some casualties off a Wraith who weren't that badly hurt, so we put them to work and then they disappeared. About that time, someone in Hull and Architecture went spacey and started claiming they were Blood Horde agents or something. Anyway, nobody can track them down, and there's a sort of alert.
Nothing official yet?
No. Unless this is it.
All personnel, report to nearest lift tube bay on deck 7 and 8 for identification confirmation. All personnel.
Baron and the others in sight drifted toward the nearest lift tube bay.
You know, this is stupid. They'll never find anyone in this maze. 5 arms, the core, 18 decks, all the dead space here and there, let alone the inventory bays. It's impossible.
Baron remembered what Esme had told him about the internal scan evidence used in her trials.
If it really is a Blood Horde assault group, they better find them. Anyway, we've got internal scan in every compartment. They'd have to know how to disable it to escape detection. Shouldn't be that hard to track them, even in a ship this size.
What could they do anyway? If we don't find them, they'll just rattle around. Can't be but a few.
The other ensign slowed as the crowd ahead came in sight. Baron thought of what Esme had told him about the mutiny and what he'd heard of Harris Serrano's capture of Garavay's cruiser.
It doesn't take many to create havoc if they get command of the bridge.
All at once, the ship, which had seemed too large to be a ship, too safe to be interesting, felt fragile in the immensity of space. He tried to tell himself again that internal scan would find the intruders, but there were compartments without full pickup, and the volume of data alone would make it easy to miss significant details. That new AI system, which had already glitched on keeping up with the changes in the layout, could it really handle a job like this? Baron joined the line forming in front of a Kosciusko crewman wearing security patches. Ahead of him, others asked the questions he wanted answered, but the answers weren't coming.
Just look in here. Handprints there. I feel a pinch. Now move along.
Full ID checks.
Baron hadn't been through a full ID check since he entered the academy.
Could someone fake a retinal scan or handprint pattern?
Behind him, the line thickened. It was taking at least a minute to process each person and hand out a new ID tag. He occupied his mind with the obvious calculation, a max of 60 people an hour through each checkpoint, and they had 10 checkpoints.
It would be hours and hours before they'd confirmed and issued new tags to the whole crew.
Look in here, sir. And your hands. You'll feel a pinch.
Baron blinked from the flash as the machine checked his retinal pattern. He felt a sharp pinprick as it drew his blood to check against his record. Baron took the bright pink tag they offered. Unlike his old one, it didn't have his picture, just the shiny strip that would allow Scan to recognize him as legitimate. Even as he walked off on his way to inventory for the parts Voorhees had wanted, he saw more security personnel arriving with more screening equipment. He took the tube up to Deck 13 and gave his request to the Master Chief, who was supervising the automated retrieval system. She did not have one of the new pink ID tags, but nodded toward his.
I expect the captain will shut down the automated system soon, and then I can go get my new tags. You're lucky you got here now.
Soon enough, one of the little robo-carts slid up to the door with his order. The chief checked it off.
Do you need transport, sir?
Baron eyed the load.
No, thank you.
Fine, then.
Baron picked up the packaged components and decided not to take the tube back down. He could walk around the core, clockwise with the traffic, then take the ladder up to Deck 12 and be in the tech school's inventory for the other things Voorhees wanted. And he might see something.
If they are intruders and they are Blood Horde, what would they look like?
All he knew about the Blood Horde was that they favored tall blondes. As he passed the base of T5, he could see into the ship's security bay, which looked like a kicked anthill. Why couldn't he have been in the ship's own crew? He could imagine himself easily as that lieutenant of security, the one scowling at him now as if to wonder what an ensign from the 14th's remote sensing section was doing here. It would be a lot more interesting than his job. He wouldn't see any intruders or any enemy on the outside either. He strode on, wishing hives on the person who'd assigned him to scan on a DSR instead of something suitable to a Serrano. The school's inventory, when he got there, was empty. He leaned on the counter, tempted to stick his hand in the console and find out where the parts were that he wanted. It wasn't safe, really. If everyone was lined up getting new ID tags, who was making sure the intruders didn't get into someplace like this? Although, why they'd want to... At the sound of footsteps, he felt his pulse quicken again.
Intruders?
Baron glanced around and saw nothing useful as a weapon. But the plump sergeant coming into view, his cheeks scarlet with exertion, wore a new pink ID tag.
Sorry, sir. I had to run up all the ladders. They've turned off the lift tubes just in case, which is ridiculous. It only makes more work for the rest of us.
Baron handed over his list.
Perhaps they're concerned that the intruders might cut the power to the lift tubes.
You don't think they would?
I don't know what they'd do, but if someone wanted to cause trouble, that's one way to do it.
Stupid. Let's see. Aisle 8, level 2, tray 13. Just a moment, then.
The school's inventory had never been automated, and Baron waited while the sergeant found his items and handed them over. Baron signed the terminal and headed back. Should he use the ladders here? T1 was probably less crowded. Or go on around and straight down in T3? He split the decision, dropping to Deck 6, then going around core to T3 for the final descent to Deck 4. Voorhees had found the place, one of the maintenance shafts for the lift tube clusters, this one at the inboard junction of T3 and T2 on Deck 6, on his way to the meal at which he'd picked up the disgustingly dull knife and fork now hidden under his jumpsuit. He'd found Metris again and passed the word. Metris would pass it on, as he would.
How long do we have?
His blood sang with excitement, clearing away the dregs of the sleepy gas. This was nothing like the usual shipboarding, when they blasted their way in, weapons in hand, to take swift control of some fat, lazy trader. This was a real challenge. He wondered if anyone had noticed their weapons and equipment back on Wraith. They'd found the mine. That was common gossip, which they were glad to tell a presumed Wraith crewman.
It would have blown you to hell and back if our people hadn't found it and foamed it down.
But had they foamed the inner compartments too? If so, his favorite knives and tools might be safely embedded in the foam, and he could retrieve them later. It had been his grandfather's battle knife, too. He wanted it back. They needed weapons. He knew he could take any two or three of these effete technicians barehanded, but there were thousands of them. His whole team together could kill dozens, but it would not be enough. Somewhere on this monster ship were weapons of all sorts, hand weapons and ship weapons, ammunition, power packs, everything. He just had to find it. His supposed supervisor wasn't watching him closely. He walked off casually in the direction of the dumps. They called them heads for reasons he'd never figured out. Short for shithead, he assumed, which still made no sense. He felt eyes on him and glanced back to see his supervisor looking annoyed. The man shrugged as Vokrace went on through the door. Inside were three others, a man and two women. Vokrace eyed the women. The Blood Horde hired some female mercenaries, but they fought in all-female units. That was the natural way. Otherwise, men would think of nothing but rut day in and day out. He was thinking of it now, as the tall red-haired one was washing her hands. She looked into the mirror, met his gaze, and scowled at him.
Scowl all you wish. You'll be tossed at my spear before morning.
When they left, he explored the echoing space with its seamless hard floor, its shiny walls. He found two other doors. One opened into a storage closet, and one into a different corridor. He tested the top of the closet. He could get out that way if he had to, but chose to walk out the other door as if he had come in that way. Here, he would have no pesky supervisor watching his every move. He tried to remember where his pack second had been sent and thought of using the data wand.
Need some help?
Vokrace managed not to strike, but his move was sudden enough that the man, older, gray-haired, stepped back, startled.
Sorry, timing's still off.
He gestured to his ID tag, which had the Wraith ship code on it.
Oh, I thought perhaps you were lost or something. That's a slow stream data port. If you want a quick answer to anything, there's a fast stream down there.
I would like to find the other survivors.
Vokrace struggled to remember the names on the uniform tags.
Kamaho, Bremerton.
You know their numbers?
No, Vokrace didn't know their mythical numbers that went with their mythical names. He shook his head.
Search on Wraith should get him.
The man put his own wand into a port a few meters away. Vokrace noticed that this one had a double ring around it, blue and green. The one he had been using had a double band of yellow and green.
Here you are. I'll transfer it to yours.
He reached for Vokrace's data wand, then snugged it next to his for a moment and handed the wand back.
Thanks.
The man nodded and strode off. Vokrace looked at the display options and walked down the corridor as if thinking, looking at the names and duty assignments coming up.
Will that man remember me? Report me? Will anyone be expected to know about the color codings on the data ports?
He'd felt smug that he'd recognized a data port at all. Hoke was indeed in hull and architecture, in Wing T3 and on Deck 4. Vokrace considered the distance and cursed to himself. What misbegotten, brain-dead fool of an engineer had designed this ship? It made no sense. A space station with an oversized drive, that's what it was, not a ship at all. He was wasting too much time hunting people, but he could hardly get on the ship speaker. Surely they had a ship speaker, and call. He spotted another of his people lounging along, looking the picture of a lazy incompetent, and signaled him. Sramet wandered over, and Vokrace told him where to meet and that he would find Hoke.
Don't slouch like that. At least look like you're on business.
Sramet nodded and put on the character of earnest, hard-working dullness, as if he had pulled a mask over his head. And that was another thing lost in Wraith. Not only their technical expert and their weapons, but their tools and their special gear that included disguises and camouflage. Hoke, when he found him, was being chewed out by one of the Familius NCOs.
And you can take your sorry tail back to Commander Adderin's clerk and explain that Petty Major Dorian won't have you on the crew. Is that clear?
Hoke caught Vokrace's eye, but his expression of sullen incompetence did not change.
Yes, sir.
Get on with it, then!
The NCO, suppressed fury in every line of his body, stalked off down the passage. Hoke looked straight at Vokrace and nodded. He would kill that one when he found him again.
We have a place, Deck 6, in the port junction of T3 and T2. A maintenance shaft for the lift tubes. I've only two of our brothers so far. This thing is too big.
I'll go too. Do you know where they are?
Volcrace was able to repeat the trick he had just learned, mating his data wand with Hulk's to transfer the list of personnel locations.
We're going to be discovered soon. I can feel it. We don't fit in with these...
slaves.
Careful. We still have to do it.
In my sleep, pack leader.
Go, pack brother. Make one sweep clockwise. They all seem to go clockwise on the big passage around the core. And then meet. I want to make one trip as far upship as I can get before they realize we're aboard.
Hoch's eyes gleamed and his arm twitched. He moved off to the left. Volcrace went across to the nearest cluster of lift drop tubes and shot upward. He had enjoyed the swift ride many times on his visits to Familia space stations. The Blood Horde had sufficient trouble with the technology of gravity control that they used lift tubes rarely, never for such distances. He didn't suppose it would take him all the way to the top, but there it was, Deck 17. He stepped out into the same wide, curving corridor, here less busy than down on Deck 4. He walked along briskly as if he knew where he was going. A bored guard stood at an opening that might lead to the bridge on the core side. Volcrace didn't try to look in. His shoulders itched. He knew he was being watched. He walked on, most of the way around the core, surprised to find no other lift tube clusters, as there had been on the lower decks. Did only one set come this far? He didn't want to go back past the first guard like someone who had lost his way. He came to another guarded opening. Here, the guard looked more alert, eyes shifting back and forth. Volcrace could see the bulge of lift tubes ahead, but before that was a wide opening into T2. It had the label above, and he remembered that the dining hall had also been in T2. He looked in and almost stumbled in amazement. The place was full of plants, green plants. He turned in through the door as if this was what he'd intended all along and felt the guard's attention drop from him like a heavy load. Beneath his feet, something that almost felt like soil cushioned his steps. He ambled along a path, seeing no one. Paths met the one he was on, diverged, wound around taller plants that made screens so that he could not tell how large this place was. The path ended abruptly in a waist-high wall of fake stone. He felt it and was sure it was molded. A path ran beside the wall to rustic fake stone steps to his left. Below was more garden, and one enormous tree rising up past him to end 15 meters over his head. Behind it, a rough-looking gray wall with patches of blurred white on which someone was splayed out as if for sacrifice, arms wide, legs stretched apart. As he watched, the figure heaved upward, lost its grip, and fell. Volcrace watched the fall, waiting for the satisfying thunk, but instead the climber jerked to a halt in midair and hung swinging. Now he could see the thin line looped far above and coming back to the hand of someone standing beside the wall. He started down the steps.
Well, the fleet plan is finally schooling their troops in hostile boarding techniques. But if so, why not have them in gear they'd need? Why practice in thin short pants and little rag-like shirts?
From the garden on Deck 16, he ran down one of the sets of stairs. Stairs in stairwells, as in a building, not ladders, as in a real ship, to Deck 14, then went out on the main curved passage again to catch the drop tube down to Deck 6. He could have used the access shaft itself, checking it out as he came, but he was eager to see how many people Hoch had collected. When he came through the hatch, he saw nothing at first, which was what he expected to see. Above and below, the shaft seemed empty, a smudged gray tube with a spiral ladder curling around bundled cables and pipes in the middle. Volcrace grinned, noting where lights had burnt out in helpful places. His pack appeared, one after another moving out of the shadows, out of hatches that opened into other access tunnels, out of whatever cover they'd found. One by one, they came up or down the ladder to cluster near him. 1, 3, 4, 6, 10, plus himself and Hoch. 12 only, and not enough. He scowled at Hoch.
Is this all?
No, but all who could come safely right now. 3 more coming, then they can slip away. Shramit saw Pilan and Vrodik, but couldn't speak to them long enough. Gela is the only one nobody's seen or reported on.
Vokreis pulled out the knife and fork he'd taken.
Who has weapons?
They don't carry weapons. Not even the ones with weapon systems patches.
Two others had stolen dinner knives. Brolt had already started to sharpen his to a stabbing point.
The contractors?
They're here. But we haven't contacted them yet.
So, we don't know about the mechanism. It would be better to find out for ourselves without asking them. I don't trust them.
Vokreis's distrust had brought them all here. He had argued successfully that even if the scum were honest, they might panic and undo the job once they realized their own necks were in danger. Later, his plan had expanded. If they were quick enough, his warband would have the entire glory to themselves, the richest capture in the history of the Blood Horde.
We could take them. We could make sure they did it right.
We do need a few hostages.
They won't care.
Familius is different. Besides, we need some of their technical tricks. We're supposed to know how to do things we don't understand.
They nodded. They'd all found that out in only the few hours. Astounding that a warship crew, even down to the fewest of stripes, would be expected to understand all the gadgetry. But so it had proved. Only the fact that they'd been gassed, and assumed to have residual problems from that, had kept them from being discovered simply by their ignorance.
If we get one of the right family, it'll slow them down. They'll start to think about it. They'll try a rescue. Then we get more.
So you want us to pick certain needles out of a stack of thousands?
If they come handy. Here, shove that wand into the port, and let's get a crew list.
It was a blue and green ringed port, Vokreis noticed. Hoke put his wand in, and information appeared in little glowing letters projected on the air itself.
We want someone in scan, so they can tell us how to disable their miserable systems without blowing them away. The question is, do we want someone on the ship's crew? Someone from the schools division, or the heavy maintenance division?
Heavy maintenance. From what I heard, they've made all sorts of modifications to the original ship's architecture. The crew may not know about it, but those in maintenance will.
In a few minutes, they had a list of personnel assigned to remote sensing, 14th Heavy Maintenance Yard.
Commander Voorhees, that won't work. He'll be surrounded by people all the time. Lieutenant Bandal, and Serrano. Serrano. Wasn't that the bitch who caused us trouble at Xavier?
And an important fleet family. Even though he's only an ensign, that'll make them take notice.
Ha! If he knows enough, he's only an ensign. The lieutenant I found in Hull in architecture isn't an expert. The junior officers can be sent here for short runs.
If he doesn't know enough, we can snatch another from scan. The family connection alone will be useful.
Hostage of vengeance?
Well, we tell them it's a hostage.
They understood that. This Serrano cub would go back to his family, if he did, toothless and tamed. A warning not to interfere with Blood Horde nobles.
Now, have you all used the mapping function on these things?
Heads shook, and Vokreis glared at them. They'd come for the technology. They should be learning to use it. The data wands weren't difficult. He put his own in the port this time, telling them about the fast and slow ports as if he'd known it all along. Then he switched to the open display, and the ship graphics glowed before them.
We need a higher access probe to find everything we want. So we need to kill someone in ship security with lots of stripes and use theirs. But here you can see...
He pointed out the bridge, the secondary command center tucked in between the two FDL drives, the medical decks, and the ship security offices on T5.
They'll have weapons and security, and if we knock out their security personnel, we've eliminated resistance. In medical, they'll have more of that sleepy gas and the antidotes.
Eye for eye.
All personnel, report to nearest lift tube bay on deck 7 and 8 for identification confirmation. All personnel, report to nearest lift tube bay.
Hoke stuck his data wand back in the port, this time choosing the faster display, which only the user could see.
They caught on. They're pulling everyone in for identification checks. full scale, whatever that means.
They know something's wrong, but they don't know where we are. It'll take them a while to do the checks and issue new ID tags. Hours, probably. In the meantime, they won't even know how many of us there are. Vanta, Pormach, you'll get us new tags. Try to dispose of the bodies where it'll take a while to find them. Get the data ones, too. If you see any more of our people, sweep them up. Hook, take two, three if you must, and get those contractors. We need to know where the self-destruct is, and be sure the captain can't use it. The rest of you, come with me. We need weapons, especially as we're short-handed right now.
We come back here?
No. They have guns on this ship, if you can believe it. Maybe more than one. But at the top of T2, deck 16 and 17. Lots of places to hide, and many ways in and out. There's a big tree, you can't mistake it. And an assault wall.
If we're seen.
Capture or kill. And don't capture more than you can handle on the move. They know they've got trouble. We'll show them how much!
Slow smiles answered him. They liked this much better than pretending to be soft-bellied fleet techs.
Go!
Captain Haken, wearing his own new ID tag, looked as grim as expected when he met with the other senior officers aboard. He had called them to the officers' lounge nearest the bridge, where officers just going off or coming on duty met informally. Now the room was guarded by security personnel, their wary eyes watching everyone in sight.
The Wraith crew members who came aboard as casualties from the forward compartments have not appeared for ID checks. We have forwarded what little video scan we have to Captain Seska aboard Wraith, and he is sure that at least 8 of those were never his personnel. He is showing every image to his remaining crew to check on the ones he said he wasn't sure of. But we must assume that all 25 Wraith casualties who were not injured and who were sent to work assignments by Chief Barahide are actually imposters. We do not know where they came from. I understand that Lieutenant Sweeza had a notion that they might be Bloodhorde intruders. If so, this ship is in even more peril than we thought.
Admiral Dossignol sat forward in his seat.
Any sign of a Bloodhorde ship?
No, Admiral. However, the situation with regard to our escort is tenuous.
Admiral Levati looked up.
Tenuous?
Yes. Sting and Justice, as the Admiral recalls, were assigned to patrol the same area as Wraith. Their captains insisted on returning to that patrol area, arguing that they could then guard the exit jump point there if the Bloodhorde tried to use it. That made sense before we knew about the mine on Wraith. They'd been long gone by the time we suspected that intruders had come aboard.
And our present escort?
Is useless if the intruders gain control of this ship. They could destroy Kosciusko, of course, if they were ordered to do so. But who is to give the order? I have made it clear to both captains that they should do precisely this, if they think the ship has been captured. But they have not yet agreed. Captain Plethys said he did not feel certain he could know that the ship had been irrevocably lost, even if he could not make positive identification of an officer on the crew list on a comlink. He argued that communications capacity might be interdicted by the intruders without their actually gaining control.
Which is quite possible.
Quite so. In fact, any type of signal could, in theory, be interdicted by the intruders before they gained control. Captain Martin agreed with Captain Plethys and added that he did not wish to be responsible for the considerable destruction of life and material, even if the intruders did appear to control this ship. He argued that the rest of the wave will no doubt return to guard us, and offered his ship to go and explain the situation. I insisted that he stay, but I'm not sure he will.
You think he'll desert us in the face of enemy attack? That's treason.
There are no enemy ships on scan, and he knows he can do nothing about the intruders already aboard. He probably thinks that will clear him with the Board of Inquiry.
Not if I'm around to argue it.
I agree, but if I remember Captain Martin, and I believe this is the same Arlen Martin I once attempted to teach military justice to, he's got a mind like an eel. Twisting and slithering away is his nature. I never did understand why he was given a ship.
So you think he'll go?
Probably. Certainly, if his scan techs can locate an enemy ship at a distance where he thinks we can't, then he'll claim he didn't know it was there. He doesn't make mistakes, you see.
Then, sirs, I'm faced with a dilemma which you have probably already anticipated. When do I throw the switch?
The switch?
The Admiral will recall that this ship, unlike vessels intended for combat, carries a self-destruct device, and my orders are unequivocal. If I believe that the Kosciuszko is in imminent danger of capture by a hostile force, I am to prevent such capture and appropriation by the enemy, by destroying the ship and, if necessary, her entire complement of personnel.
Are you serious?
Quite. We've talked about how useful this ship would be to the Blood Horde, their own private shipyard capable of manufacturing two or three fully armed cruisers just with the material in inventory, and with resupply of the most basic type, capable of building a battle group. Right now, it's full of the very people who know how to use it, some of whom, faced with torture or death, would cooperate with the Blood Horde, at least long enough to train replacements.
Nobody would.
I'm begging the Admiral's pardon, but no military organization in the history of man has had zero failure rate in any system, including the human system. The recent action at Xavier, and for that matter, Captain Martin, shows that Fleet is no exception. Besides, even if every person now aboard this vessel chose death, the Blood Horde can hire civilians from all over the galaxy to operate what they can't figure out.
But surely, we're not at that point yet. There are only a few Blood Horde aboard. Security will no doubt pick them up in a few hours.
The point at which I should push the button is before the Blood Horde have a chance to prevent it working. Do you think they haven't assumed such a device exists? Do you think they're not looking for it right now, disarming it if they found it? They don't want to lose this ship any more than we do, but the only way I can ensure that we don't lose it is to destroy it.
You're right, Captain. That's a tough decision. Are you asking for advice?
It's my decision. My responsibility. But I'll be glad to hear your ideas on choosing the right time. Only realize that the right time must be too soon rather than too late.
How do you test the device integrity, and what's your normal test cycle?
It's tested weekly by partially arming the device. It has its own control board, with the usual sensors array and so on. I have a vid scan of it so I can see the attached status lights. And I also have scan that reports whether the circuits are functioning correctly.
So, have you tested it since the intruders came aboard?
Not yet. My concern, though, is that even if it tests out now, they could find and disable it at any time.
You've put a guard on it?
Yes. But as you know, we need security personnel in other areas, including searching for the intruders. They might overpower the guard.
Still, I should give you some warning. If the guard doesn't report, if the vid scan changes, you can test the system while the guard is there, can't you?
Yes.
Would you like a witness to the test?
Yes, I would.
And my suggestion is that you test it now, immediately. And my second suggestion is that you jump back out of this system, which would make it harder for the Blood Horde group we expect to find us.
And for our ships as well.
Yes, that's true. But avoiding a Blood Horde assault group seems more important at this juncture. I'm convinced that with over 25,000 loyal personnel on board, we can deal with the intruders, be they Blood Horde commandos or any other hostile group. As long as they aren't reinforced by outside forces.
Very well.
Haken spoke to the guard at the door and led them across to the bridge. Lieutenant Bondal stared at his status board.
The captain asketh and the admiral respondeth.
Baron pulled himself away from another daydream, this one of himself rescuing Esme Suiza from faceless Blood Horde goons.
Sir?
All that vid scan that's supposed to be watching every square centimeter of this ship, which in theory could find the intruders?
Yes.
Isn't there, or isn't working, and the captain has quite reasonably asked the 14th to come to his aid. So we, you and I, for example, replace, install, and somehow I suspect the intruders, whoever they are, will manage to undo what we did right after us.
I hope not. Why doesn't the captain seal off the different wings? He could do that, couldn't he?
He could blow us all to Kingdom Come if he wanted to, or turn off the artificial gravity, or... I don't know why he's done what he's done, or why he'll do what he's doing. It's not my problem. Scan is my problem. I know you went to inventory only an hour or so ago, Ensign, but you'll have to go back.
That's what Ensigns are for. That's what you said yesterday. Scut work, gophering...
I'm making smart-ass remarks. Yes, you're well on your way to a successful career as an Ensign, my boy.
Baron winced dramatically. Lieutenant Bondal had a freakish sense of humor, but was easy to work with if he thought it was appreciated. And he knew his business, which made the teasing worthwhile.
Traffic in the corridors was down, except for the line still backed up at the ID station. Baron flashed his pink pass at the guard before entering the lift tube. It was like being back at school, where you'd had to have a hall slip to use the toilet. He decided not to make that remark to the grim-faced guard watching him. In the aftermath of the ship-wide identification verifications, Baron understood why the automatic inventory racks had been disabled. With hostiles aboard, the captain didn't want anyone confused by the sudden shift of a rack. If it shifted now, they'd know it was enemy action. Still, that made retrieving a component stored on the second-to-top rack, at the rear, a time-consuming procedure. He looked up, checking the rack numbers. Yes, 58 GD4 was up there, and what he needed should be on it. He looked at the maintenance ladder with its warning signs and tangle of safety harness. Danger. Vibration from moving racks. Clip in before using. But the racks wouldn't be moving, and putting on the harness would slow him down. On the other hand, he'd look pretty stupid if he slipped for some reason and broke an arm. Lieutenant Bondall would be furious. They were short-handed already, what with the intruder scare. The harness felt awkward. He was three-quarters sure he didn't need it. The safety clip fit around a rod beside the ladder steps, but had to be unclipped and reclipped every 5 or 6 rungs. He glanced around. He hoped no one was watching his clumsy caution. Up the first level, then the second. It was annoying to stop and unclip and clip every single time, even though he was getting faster at it.
Damn!
Baron's heart raced a moment, then quieted. It had to be a crewmate. The last reported sighting of the hostiles had been 2 decks down and over on the starboard side, 1 kilometer away and only 5 minutes before. Should he call out and identify himself? Probably.
Yo!
Who else is here?
From his perch, now 8 racks off the deck, Baron could see a brown head moving along an aisle, a familiar uniform, though the angle was wrong to see insignia.
You all right?
Fine. Up here.
The person looked up and grinned.
You hear me trip over the vent hatch someone left undogged?
Vent hatch undogged? Where?
The man pointed back toward the compartment entrance. Baron saw by his stripes that he was a sergeant minor.
Back there. Inboard ventilation access hatch. Probably some idiot guardsman went through looking for the bad guys and forgot to close it behind him.
We can hope.
Baron felt cold, and he wasn't sure why. He glanced around. The inventory racks ran up to the overhead, 15 meters from the deck, divided by aisles and cross aisles, usually humming with robotic carriers. He couldn't see far in any direction but along that one aisle. The racks he climbed beside were 1/2 meter high, but the ones across from him were 1 full meter, some full and some partly empty. Plenty of room for someone to hide, even in the 1/2 meter racks.
What were you looking for?
57GD11, code number 3362F3B. Scrubber port covers. Should be around here somewhere.
I'm on 58GD4, if that's any help.
Baron watched as the other man peered at one rack after another.
Here it is.
The other man started up the ladder of a stack 2 down from Baron without putting on the harness. Baron started to say something to him, but shrugged. He hadn't needed his own harness so far. He turned back to his own ladder. He had a long way to go. By the time he was up 10 more levels, he was breathing hard. A vertical 15 meters wasn't like the short 3-meter ladders he was used to. The climbing wall was only 10 meters. Still, he was over halfway. He looked up. The remaining racks seemed to loom over him. He glanced around for the other climber. No sign of him.
Did he just find his items and leave?
Baron leaned out against the safety belt, trying to see. Nothing. When he looked down, nothing but deck showing in the aisle. Odd. He'd have expected the other man to say something when he left. Baron shrugged, finally, and climbed up another rack level, reaching up over his head to clip in the safety line.
That's odd.
As his eyes came level with the rack edge, the cold, round muzzle of a riot gun prodded him under the chin. It looked exactly like the ones that ship security carried.
Don't move.
Baron stiffened for a moment he would later realize was critical. Then someone grabbed his ankles. He arched back, trying to kick loose. The barrel of the gun slammed into the side of his head hard enough to stun. He struggled, but now something had caught his safety harness and pulled him hard against the ladder. His feet, then his arms, and finally another blow to the head that dropped him into a dark hole where he was only vaguely aware of being dragged off the ladder and onto the chill metal mesh of the inventory rack. Baron felt too many things to sort out easily. His feet bumping over some surface with regular obstructions, his shoulders painfully cramped from the traction on his arms. His head throbbed, with occasional flashes of brighter pain that left ghostly spikes across his vision. Other things hurt too. His ribs, his left hip, his wrists. But where was he? He tried to ask this, but choked on the gag in his mouth. Something soft, cloth or another soft material, that he could not spit out, though he tried. The part of his brain that could think suggested caution, waiting to see what happened. But between the choking and the dark, his body's instincts opted for action. He flared his nostrils, trying to suck in more air, and twisted as hard as he could.
You're a Serrano?
Baron concentrated on breathing. His nose felt like a pillow-sized mass of pain, and no air went that way. His captors had loosened the gag so he could breathe through his mouth. It had been clear that this was a privilege they could revoke at any moment. He could barely see through his eyelashes, which seemed to be glued together. When he tried to blink, his eyelids hurt, and his vision didn't clear.
We don't like Serranos, but we do recognize your value as a hostage. For now, you might even be valuable enough to let live past the capture of this vessel. It's possible that you'd even make it to Athar's world. A Serrano in the arena would be a profitable attraction.
The small part of Baron's brain that was still rational realized that these must be Bloodhorde soldiers, the hostiles that everyone was searching for. His memory dredged up a précis of what Fleet Intelligence knew about the arena on Athar's world.
Well, that's one reaction. Personally, I always look forward to Fight Week.
He could be that knock on the head.
No, he's a Serrano, and I have it on good authority that they are solid granite all the way through.
It was not a good sign that his captors were talking so much. It meant they felt safe. They must be somewhere they did not expect to be found, or overheard, which meant they'd done something to the ship's sensors. The stench of vomit didn't seem to bother his captors. They left the gag loose, which argued that they didn't want him to choke on his vomit if he heaved again. He blinked, and one eye cleared suddenly, giving him a view of uniforms that looked exactly like his own, only cleaner. A Wraith ship patch on the arm nearest him, with the stripes of a corporal. He couldn't see the name tag. Another beyond. He blinked again, and his other eye came unstuck. Now he could see that one was watching him closely, cool gray eyes in a broad face. The name tag read Santini. The stripes indicated a pivot major. The expression said killer, and proud of it. Baron struggled to regain the moral high ground. He knew what was expected of a Serrano in a tight fix. Triumph, despite all odds. Escape, certainly. Capture the bad guys, ideally. All it took was brains, which he had, and courage and physical fitness, both of which he was supposed to have. His grandmother could do it in her sleep. Any of the great Serranos could. He didn't feel like a great Serrano. He felt like a boy with no experience, whose nose was at least as big as a parpon ball, who hurt all over, who was surrounded by big, dangerous men who intended to kill him. In other words, helpless. He hated feeling helpless. But even that resentment couldn't wake the surge of defiant anger he needed.
Do it anyway.
If he couldn't feel brave, he could still use his brain. He let his eyelids sag almost shut again. That man was not a pivot major named Santini, but he had a name, and perhaps his companions would use it. He might learn what it was, even though he didn't know their language. At least he should be able to figure out the command structure of this group just by observation. Baron felt a sharp tug at his hair. He opened his eyes again.
You don't need to sleep, boy.
The man's voice had a hard, contemptuous edge that even his first academy instructors had not used. They had not cared if he passed or failed. This man did not care if he lived or died.
You need to learn what you are.
Someone behind him laid something cold and hard along the side of his neck. The man across from him grinned. Pain exploded in his neck. Before he could scream, the filthy gag was back in his mouth. Tears streamed from his eyes. His whole body shuddered. Then it was over.
That's what you are. Entertainment. Keep it in mind.
Baron nodded, and they all stood. He was yanked to his unsteady feet and dragged along with them as they moved off down a passageway he had never seen before. And not a single vid-scan pickup in sight.